everyone, and welcome to another episode of Upzoned, where every week we take just one big story from the news and we upzone it. We talk about it in depth. I'm Kia, and I am back this week with Chuck, who is fresh off the plane from Massachusetts and then Labor Day weekend. How are you doing, Chuck?
Great. Memorial Day weekend. You did that before.
Oh, I get them mixed up
every time. It's okay. My wife's birthday is Labor Day weekend, which here in Minnesota is like the end of summer. And Memorial Day weekend is the beginning of summer. And that's when my birthday is. So we have this like embedded in our brains, that thing in our relationship. So that's kind of fun.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, and we should say that this will air on Friday, but today, May 29th, is actually your proper actual birthday. Happy birthday, Jack. How are you doing? Do you have big plans for tonight?
We're doing a softball scrimmage today. So I get my team of girls out on the field for the first time as a team playing against another team today, which is kind of fun. We've been practicing for a month. So I think they're ready. I think they're ready for games.
Well, some people celebrate their birthdays with fancy dinners. You coach children's softball. So yeah. That's you in a nutshell. Well, I know that we're a little short on time today, so I want to dive right into our topic, which is an article from a outlet I've never heard of before called 2 Cents. They're part of the AV Club, about people who are taking out loans specifically to pay their rent. This is not a new thing, certainly. People have taken out payday loans for a long time. But what is a little bit different is that these are loans from traditional, conventional big banks that are marketed specifically towards renters. And it's normalizing the idea that it's okay to pay your rent with debt, which is a little bit different than I think what a lot of people listening to this would expect. So I sent this to you and I was like, you know, I don't know if this is substantial enough. Living in St. Louis as a landlord in particular, I know a lot of people who borrow money to pay their rent in one form or another. But you said I could talk about this for 2 hours. So I am curious to hear your thoughts on this one, Chuck.
When I saw this, I'm like, okay, this is just a number in a long line of crazy to me. Like last week, there was an article about how in the EU, and I think it was in Germany, but I'm not positive, somewhere in Europe, banks were actually issuing negative amortizing mortgages. So you would go to the bank and get a mortgage, and the mortgage would be at a negative interest rate. In other words, every month you collect a check from the bank for having a mortgage. And when you look at this, like this idea that here's a, not a payday loan thing, not a fringe thing, not like a mafioso loan shark. It's like a legit bank marketing product to people who, you know, would be not in a low end market, but in a high, these are high earners in a high market. And they're marketing these loans in a way where, like, you know, for the first 6 months, there's no interest. And then the interest jumps to 17%. You look, and to me, it's just one of these indicators that like something is really distorting the space-time fabric of the financial markets. And that's how I would almost describe it. You know, I've used this analogy before. I'm not sure if I've used it here, but interest rates are a lot like gravity. You know, we are evolved to live in a certain 9.8 square meters per second. We have a certain amount of gravity that we're used to living with. And when you take humans and you put them in space for, you know, extended period of time, their DNA actually starts to change. When we have plants and bacteria in space, their DNA actually starts to change and evolve because they're like given a different environment, you know, radically different environment that they're in. And so in a sense, like the loosening of gravity changes us at like a molecular level. In many ways, I feel like interest rates are the same thing. You know, we can loosen the gravity of interest rates, the painful constraints that kind of keep supply and demand for money in check at market clearing rates. But after a while, when we do that, what happens is that like the DNA starts to unravel. The things that are normal start to go away and you get all these kind of abnormalities creeping in. You're borrowing money to pay rent. And that's like a logical thing to do. It's done by respectable people. You're getting a negative amortizing mortgage. And we just look around and like, yeah, those are the times we're in. No, that's like crazy. That's nutty. Here in Brainerd, today is on the front page of the paper that Tim Hortons is closing. last year we had a Tim Hortons open up, and now Tim Hortons is closing.
Oh,
yeah.
Great Minnesota tragedy when a Tim Hortons closes. I'm sure there are riots in the streets.
It was kind of weird because, you know, it was the Canadian donut places like foray down south into like-minded peoples, I think is what they were thinking. There's nothing wrong with a Tim Hortons here. I never went, but I'm guessing it was doing fine, just like a Herberger's was doing fine. And some of the others, you know, JCPenney's, the store was doing fine. What happened is that their financing got screwed up. They basically finance things in a way and were kind of induced to get in over their heads. And then things started to shift and they couldn't make up their loan payments. They got sunk by debt, not by the profitability of their individual stores. These are the crazy kind of things that happen when you distort the underlying gravity of money. And I think we scratch our heads and are like, boy, this is a unique story. Like, this is really weird. Why would someone take out a loan to pay their rent? I mean, that's just like the most illogical thing. But then we just move on. And the reality is, if you step back and look at it, there's just example after example after example of things that should not happen, that don't make sense. Ridiculously high housing prices in some markets being one of them, that for some reason we've just come to accept as normal and chalk it up as like, this is the way it is. And I feel like it's just this massive distortion of the gravity of the financial markets.
We talk about this in slightly different language because you come from, you know, a markets background and you talk about distortion in a way that's a little foreign to me. But speaking personally, I totally agree. You know, I'm a landlord in St. Louis and we took on a tenant once who always struggled to pay her rent to us. Like every single month, it was a really big problem. And she made enough money. We had screened her. We had checked her credit. We had done all this stuff. But what became clear after a while was that she had taken out from a credit union a Freedom loan is what they call it in St. Louis, in order to pay her rent. And that 6-month grace period or whatever it was had been used up and she owed 14 to 17% on that loan. So she was prioritizing basically paying back the bank for what she had paid to her old landlord over what she was paying to her current landlord. And what was most challenging about it was that it had kind of distorted the way that she viewed her obligation to pay her rent in a way I didn't really expect. She was like, I have this bigger loan and I can talk to you as an individual person, as your landlord. You're not going to charge me 14 to 18%. I'm going to do what's rational. I'm going to pay back the bank first and you'll get your money when you get your money, which, you know, we kind of put the kibosh on that. But I wonder about the psychological effects of entering debt into the rental equation, because it's certainly in there for lots of people in various forms. But as we normalize it and make it more of like a thing that everyone does when they experience a job loss or they first move to a new city, of course, you're going to like take out the 0% interest loan. What happens on a grand scale?
I'm going to walk you through like the hard part of this and maybe make the opposite case of what I've been making thus far, just so we can hear this out. So if we go back before easy credit, we have to recognize that there have always been poor people and they've always struggled financially to make ends meet. But if you look and you're like, okay, what happened when a poor person struggled before easy credit? Well, what would happen is that they would wind up going to maybe a family or a relative or a loved one or a friend. That might be a thing you would do. But, you know, if that didn't work out or if you went to that well too many times, you would wind up in basically like the unregulated credit market, which we could also call like the mob or some less than savory place where you would borrow money. Or you would go to like the rich local patron who would exact a really high personal fee for this transaction. So our switch to easier credit was in a sense like an attempt to liberate people who had very few options, but had these struggles. And these are very like human struggles, right? So now you don't have to go to the mob anymore. You can go to the pawnbroker, or you can go to the payday loan, or now you can go to, you know, Morgan Stanley and get your rental loan or whatever. And no one's going to come and break your knees if you don't pay. You might have to go through a bankruptcy hearing, but we have some protections for you. It's nicer than getting your fingers chopped off. So that's what we did. The other side of this, though, is that we've now created this system that is like wholly dependent on growing the amount of debt. in order to kind of keep the system rotating, keep the system moving. I have a friend who's a banker here in town, and he does all the kind of standard loans that a local bank would do. And he's told me a couple of times, he's like, Chuck, you would be astounded. It's not an income thing. He said the doctors that live out on Gull Lake here, which is like the high-end lake, the doctors have the big lake homes out there, they're like paycheck to paycheck. They don't have, there's a lot of them that don't have any money at all. And they've got tons of debt. And they're making their payments and they're making ends meet, but they're not saving money. They're in like way overhead. He said, then there's a lot of people who are on the struggling end who, you know, borrow small sums of money and then work to pay it back. It's not an income thing. What we've done is we've kind of distorted this market in such a way as to make like easy credit available to people all the time. I remember as a college student, you know, as an undergrad, so this was like the mid 90s. If you went to McDonald's or Taco Bell at the University of Minnesota, there was always a person standing outside there selling credit cards. And you could sign up for a credit card and they would give you like a voucher for lunch. I signed up for like 30 credit cards. I would not use my social security. You know, I would basically like fill it out goofy. I would sign up for these credit cards and they're just trying to get like people who need money, easy access to money in ways that they can come back and then charge basically extortionary interest rates. I don't know how to fix this. I really don't, because I'm not arguing that we go back to like the mob. But on the other hand, it's like we become so prolific. We've induced a lot of people that I think otherwise would have sound money practices into like crazy money practices. And then on the other hand, if you can make your rent with a loan, the guy charging you rent, and that's you sometimes, you know, in your instance, can actually have higher rents. And that means they can pay more for the property. And that means the property goes up in value. And that means more people have to be renters instead of owners. It's this like weird distorting feedback loop that, like I said, I feel like has distorted the gravity of the financial markets. When you mess with interest rates, which we now have a decade of near zero interest rates that came after a decade or more of like sub market rate interest. So we've got basically a generation now of distorted interest rates. You're messing with the gravity of the whole system. To me, it's like no shock that we should see these like weird things prop up, like three-eyed fish and you know, people with tails. You're seeing these like weird things start to happen. And what I don't get is the people who explain it as like, yeah, this is just the market. Like, this is just how things work. Because it's not. It's loony. I look at just like my kids. And I've tried to, as they've grown up, teach them to save. Like we are a family that saves money. You make a dollar, you put 20, 30 cents aside, you save it. And you might need it someday, save it. Well, then we get their bank statement and they're making, it's not like 1%, it's like 0.5% interest on their loan. And they're like, well, why am I saving, Dad? And I'm like, I don't know, this is stupid.
I feel like I should ask you a very blunt question that I get fairly often, and I don't think it's the most sophisticated question, but I think it bears asking in a conversation like this, which is Strongtowns anti-debt when it comes to housing, whether that is renters should never have the option to take out this kind of a loan, whether it is, you know, we want every single home buyer to go back to like buying their house, if not all, at least mostly in cash, because we all should know by now that, you know, you didn't used to be able to buy a house for 2.5% down. You didn't used to be able to buy a house for 20% down. You had to have 50% or more in order to get a mortgage. And that's actually a pretty recent innovation. The idea of a 30-year mortgage on like a 2.5% down loan is weird. Does Strongtowns think that we just need to get rid of like banking altogether and go back to, I don't know, like a feudal system where we all keep our money under our beds and don't worry about interest at all? Just to ask the bombastic question that I'm sure is on people's minds.
It's a great question. And people ask me this too. They're like, well, you guys hate debt. And it's like, no, not at all. If I would put it in the context of Strongtowns, I think the thing that we obsess about the most is feedback. Are you getting good feedback that helps you make decisions? I have a mortgage. For me, like I've used debt in my life and I understand debt. I think the thing that is freaky is when you're not getting the painful feedback until you're way in over your head. We saw this back in 2004 during the first housing bubble, let's call it, or the middle housing bubble, maybe is a better way to put it, because we had a housing bubble in the 80s, 90s, and we had the one in 2000s, and we got the third one. During the middle housing bubble, I went to get a house. I knew what I could afford and I knew what I could pay. And when I got there, they showed me houses that were three times what I could pay. And I'm like, how can you do this? Like, I can't afford this. And they're like, oh yeah, we ran your credit thing and you can. I could, because I could afford the teaser rate at the beginning for the first 12 months. And then when it reset, I couldn't afford it at all. Like, I couldn't afford it at all. But these places were all willing to sell it to me at this like crazy teaser rate. Because, you know, it cash flowed at that point for them and they could unload it and keep the market going up. What we have done is we've become so desperate for growth that we have allowed debt. We've basically given ourselves over to the debt merchants. If I were to back up and say, what would Strongtowns, you know, what would I like to see? Like, what as an organization do we think is healthy? I think some reasonable limits on municipal debt, some private sector, just prudent limits on the amount people can borrow in terms of their income, in terms of their assets. I'm not suggesting we go back to 50% down. We, you know, have loan shark rates that people have to pay for interest. I get where we're at, and I understand we're going to have low interest rates for quite a while because we can't afford high interest rates. But what we need to do is stop the accelerating volume of debt. We actually need to like slow that down. That's going to mean making some hard decisions. But I mean, isn't borrowing money to pay your rent a hard decision, or shouldn't it be? It should be a hard decision. So I think the question comes, where do you want your hard decision? I would like the hard decision to come before we've taken on crippling amounts of debt, as opposed to after we've taken on crippling amounts of debt. We seemed as a society want to have it after we've taken on the debt.
I think that makes so much sense. And I think that's a very humane way to answer what's a real problem for like a real choice that for many American households, which is how are you going to pay the rent? But when you look at it from a systems level, there's just so much to be done upstream of rebanking our approach to finance and debt that can help people downstream who are renting. I mean, the reason that they can't afford their rent is because the housing prices are too high. It's not because they don't have easy access to credit. That's a really important reminder.
You are exactly right. And I think at the end of the day, oftentimes these policies are sold to us as like compassionate policies. And I see it as the exact opposite. The exact opposite. We just price people out. So the Tim Hortons is closing here in town because they got their financing screwed up. The reality is Tim Hortons opened because they could get easy financing, because they're a multinational corporation that could access basically junk bonds at, you know, really, really low rates and build this thing. Do you know who can't do that? The little dude here in town who wants to start a donut shop. You know, that guy can't. And that guy used to be able to. That guy used to be able to get started because prices were reasonable, startup costs were reasonable, the market was rational, and they could be a player, a competitor in a localized market. Now it's a big capital market, and they got to compete with D.R. Horton that can not only get subsidies, but can access millions of dollars of capital to build a crappy building on the edge of town with a huge parking lot, and have everything like wired for them, and they still get in financing trouble because, you know, they got too far out. This system, when people say it's, you know, the rich get richer and the poor, you know, get, yeah, this system is like wired for that. And when you hear the people saying, you know, we're going to lower interest rates to create more economic growth, we're going to print money to keep food on the shelves and, you know, help the American people, I'm so skeptical of that actually being a system that helps real people who need help, that it makes me want to scream, really. It drives me crazy.
Totally. Well, and we want to put food on people's shelves and rent in people's pockets. And we also want lots of donut shops in our towns as a donut enthusiast. So, all right, let's go to the down zone. We got a couple minutes here. I want to hear about what you have been reading and watching, listening to over your Memorial Day weekend, Chuck. Hit me.
So I did a lot of like, yard work, gardening work this weekend, which as a kid I hated, but now as an adult, like, is a ton of fun. I'm not sure why. I downloaded a book called The Shadow War, Inside Russia and China's, basically, it was a book about China and Russia. And it was written by a CNN contributor, a reporter that has toured these places. And it had to do with not only military things they're doing, but like digital satellite technology they're using, hacking, the whole like Russia interference in our election scandal, all these things they're doing to basically have like a low-level conflagration with the US that falls short of a shooting war. And I had read a little bit of this. This was a very interesting kind of concise synopsis of it. And I found it a quick read and an interesting kind of worthy read as well.
Wow. That sounds really good. I have been audiobooking as well. I'm listening to a nonfiction book called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy by Jenny Odell. Ironically, I have been listening to it while I also do housework and things like that. And so I'm failing at doing nothing. But it's actually a really fascinating book that I think Strongtowns fans will like, because what it's about is how we have reached a moment in our culture where every aspect of our society is wired to pursue constant growth. And that includes our attention. We've engineered our, like, the way we pay attention to the world to get people to, even when they are relaxing, talking to their friends, they're doing it on Facebook in such a way that is going to grow the revenues of advertisers. That, like, you can't just have a hobby. Your hobby has to be monetized. You have to sell the things you crochet on Etsy. It makes this really thoughtful point, which I'm like, I got to steal this for Strongtowns, which is that, like, we in this day and age think of growth as something that cannot include maintenance, that there isn't growth and prosperity in the act of maintaining yourself. But that obviously applies to our cities on the macro scale. And it goes into this through the lens of like visual art and labor movements and politics and all kinds of things. And I just am really, really enjoying it, even though I'm having a really hard time finding time to just sit down and listen to it and do nothing. But
I know occasionally you do nonfiction. How often do you do nonfiction?
I'd say like 40% of the time. I read a lot of nonfiction. I tend to read more like literary nonfiction more than like history. I read a lot of essays. I read a lot of memoirs. The other book I'm reading right now is Fire Shut Up in My Bones by Charles M. Blow. That's a memoir. I like nonfiction a lot. I just tend to not read the stuff that's at the front of the bookstore. I read the stuff that's in like the weird little section that they don't have a name for at the back of the bookstore. So that's more my taste. But yeah, I do want to get into reading more big ticket nonfiction because it's great stuff. There's so many fantastic writers out there.
I forgot to mention, because I wasn't on last week and I didn't do the down zone last week. There's a new book out called The Impeachers, like literally came out last week. It's about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. It was so good. I thought that I knew some of this history, and I learned a ton in this, including the why of Andrew Johnson's impeachment was a lot more fascinating than I had kind of remembered historically, just from the history lessons. But I think also this got into like the minutia of, you know, the proceedings in the House and then the vote in the Senate and the buying off of senators and the horse trading and all this. And I mean, obviously a very timely kind of book in terms of like taking a historical look at an event. But I think just people who are interested in the idea of, I found it through researching Reconstruction, but I think the idea of Reconstruction and Reconstruction politics and the divisive politics that lead to impeachment, I think it was a really insightful look, and I'd highly recommend it. That will be one of my top books of the year.
Awesome. Well,
yeah.
Stay tuned for the rest of the year to hear more about what we're reading, and Chuck always does a little rundown at the end of the year of his top books. So thank you so much for listening to Upzone. Let's end there. I know we're a little over time. We appreciate everything you do to support the show, including giving us a 5-star rating on iTunes or whatever platform of your choice, and of course, supporting the Strongtowns movement at strongtowns.org/membership. Thanks so much, and keep doing what you can to build a strong town.